great. Sensational. Terrific. What is it?
I told you.
Science. Crimeology.
Are you with me?
Not exactly with you, but somewhere nearby.
Oh.
This is Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. My name is Michael, and I don't mind getting lost in a good metaphor. Luckily, our guest this episode has been on the show before and is ready and able to deal with an allegory gone astray. Dr. David Maiman is an associate professor and the director of the Evidence-Based Cybersecurity Research Group at Georgia State University. He last joined us back in episode 14 as part of our series on cybercrime theory. But today, he's here to talk about cybercrime research in the here and now. His group is always producing interesting pieces on social media about what's happening in illicit markets. And it's been a while since our conversation, so let's drop in here as I've asked Dr. Maiman what he's seen to be going on with crime since we last spoke, and particularly during the pandemic.
One of the interesting projects that we were able to make a lot of progress on is the Darknet as well as Encrypted Communication Platform project, where we simply monitor networks of online criminals. And you know, folks probably understand that nowadays criminals are using technology and they're online all the time. So, you know, there are all kind of criminals and all kind of crimes that take place on those platforms. What I'm most interested in the context of this particular project is online fraud. During the last 3 years or so, we've been monitoring several thousands of channels, several markets, underground markets, which are being used by fraudsters to communicate with each other, sell all kind of illegal commodities, negotiate with each other, pretty much like a forum, right, that we are familiar with from the darknet. So, you know, we have a presence on the darknet, of course. We monitor many markets there, but we have seen this shift from the darknet to encrypted communication platforms during the last two and a half years or so. And so the fact that we were doing this for a while gives us this perspective. And so we can talk about this potential shift or change or emerging trends we were able to observe during COVID. I mean, we're still during a pandemic, but I guess to a lesser degree, and I'm not sure when this will be aired. But, you know, to make long story short, we started doing this before the pandemic and we're doing this, you know, for a long period of time. So we were able to observe some of the trends. In the context of online fraud, the major trend, the major shift we were able to see when the government started putting stimulus money to the citizens is a huge increase in the volume of unemployment benefit frauds, SBA loan frauds, mainly frauds against the government, trying to get some of the stimulus money. And we identified this issue early on in March of 2020. We started seeing this increase. We started to see how it spread all over the United States. So this is, you know, one of the, you know, interesting things that we were able to observe when the pandemic broke. Of course, we've seen a lot of commodities which were associated and still are with the pandemic. Commodities like face masks when we were short here in the United States, hand sanitizers, and so on and so forth. But, you know, the other major phenomenon we were able to identify during that time, and we're talking about March of 2020, was an increase in the volume of compromised bank accounts, which were offered for sale on those platforms. We're able to see many actors taking over accounts of American banks, Canadian banks, German accounts, Israeli accounts, British accounts, customers from all over, pretty much, and then offering those accounts for sale on the platforms we oversee. And that was really interesting, right? Because in the darknet, back when, you know, when things were very hot on the darknet, things were not as explosive, right? They were not as hot and as they were and still are on the platforms we're seeing. I mean, the engagement, I mean, the fact that we can engage with someone right after seeing the bank account and purchase it. I mean, the immediacy, right, of the platform was really exciting for us. And so we decided to focus attention on this type of crime and download information that is relevant to simply the online fraud ecosystem. And in that sense, the compromised bank accounts and the sales of credentials of compromised bank accounts was one of the things that we really sort of spent a lot of attention on.
I guess that moves us along to how would they have gotten those things and perhaps the topic of phishing.
So there are a couple of ways you can get access to a bank account, right? I mean, you can embed a malware in someone's computer. And before you do that, you send a phishing email. And a phishing email is essentially an email. I assume your listeners are familiar with the concept, right? It's a phishing email. It's essentially an email, a spoofed email, a fake email that will receive from their bank, but it's not really their bank. It's a criminal who pretend to be their bank. Usually on those emails, the offender will claim that an access to the bank account has been denied because there was a suspicious activity. And so what the criminal will ask the victim to do, or the target to do, we're still not a victim at this point, we're just a target. What the criminal will ask the target to do is to go on a scam page that they have put together, and which look very much like the webpage of their legitimate bank, and simply feed in their credentials in order to restore access to their account. And those scam pages, and we see those a lot, right? We see a lot of those scam pages, and they're, you know, on the platforms I mentioned, we see many vendors selling those scam pages as well. And they look, it looks amazing. I mean, the scam page look exactly, of course, like the web page, but the way the information is accumulated on the offender side is just, it's so organized. It's so efficient, sort of speaking, right? It's just awesome, right? And, you know, on the scam page, you can collect information on the, of course, victim credentials, username, password. In Canada, we know that folks are collecting information about the IP addresses. They collect information about the three questions. Some of the banks in Canada, as you know, right, are asking you to answer questions. So, you know, they collect information about those questions. And so, you know, once they get this information, they simply have access to the victim's bank account. And so the thing that essentially allows all the information to be collected is this phishing email, right? Victimization to phishing email that target clicked in. If it was a malware, then the malicious software sort of downloaded itself computer and then started collecting information and so on. And then, you know, maybe the offender would have the relevant information to your bank account using that way. But if you went to the scam page and fed in the information on the right places, then the offender would have had all your information without really accessing your computer. But the phishing email, that is essentially the door which opened you, the target, to this victimization, right? To become the victim of this type of crime.
If the web page that you end up is our metaphorical hook, then the email is the bait or the lure, the thing that gets you to go for it in the first place. And I hate actual phishing. I think it's a terrible interruption to a lovely day by the seaside. So I don't know much about how the phishing works, but from what I understand, you would select the bait that matches the kind of fish that you're trying to select. I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm going to run with that as a metaphor.
It really depends. It really depends on your goals. It really depends on what you're trying to do. It really depends on if you have a specific target that you're trying to victimize, or you just, you know, it doesn't really matter who clicks on your phishing email. And it doesn't really matter how much money you have in your bank account, or the offender doesn't really care how much money you have in your bank account, as long as they have access to their bank account. Because, you know, once they have access to your bank account, they can do pretty much what you can with your bank account.
Yeah.
And that includes sending money if you have, you know, the technology that supports it. That includes maybe washing money or laundering money. You know, everything that you can do, they can as well. So most of what we find on those platforms I indicated are accounts which belong to, know, anyone, right? I mean, anyone can fall victim to this. I mean, we don't see specific targets with millions of dollars in the accounts. We see those as well. We see many of those accounts with millions of dollars in them. But, you know, most of the accounts we see are average accounts with balances ranging between $15 to maybe $10,000 in them. The targets are targets of opportunity and not targets of choice, so to speak.
Why are people clicking on these things? What is it about these emails that make them click?
Well, we know that people click on their email because those email look legit.
Yeah.
And if you have a bank account with the specific bank, right, the specific entity you just got an email from, even though it's fraudulent, and if it looks legit, you're going to click on it, right? Because all of us are worried about our money at the end of the day. And so, you know, once people are getting those phishing emails, those phishing emails are very sophisticated. They look real to the layperson and sometimes for cybersecurity experts as well. It's very difficult to differentiate, right? And so the best thing to do, and cybersecurity experts talk about this a lot, if you are receiving an email like that from your bank, what you should be doing is you shouldn't really click on the link. What you should be doing is you should go to your, like the website you are familiar with, that you usually go to, and, you know, log into your bank account and reassure yourself that nothing is happening, or nothing suspicious is happening on your bank account. But you should never really click on the link. And that's really interesting, again, because of the fact that during the last year or so, we are seeing this increase in the volume of bank accounts, which have been taken over by bad actors, both in the United States and in Canada. We see those numbers increasing dramatically. And so more and more people are falling victims to this type of crime. And they're doing this because they're clicking on those phishing emails.
What about other types of scams, say like the ones that promise you you've won $1 million or things like that? Did specific types of fraud attract particular types of people?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we know from research is that different content will speak differently to different types of victims. We know from talking to the industry and talking to several companies who deals with phishing, some phishing emails are really vicious in the sense that it's very difficult to simply ignore them. And emails, by the way, is just, you know, one of the ways the criminals get access to your information, right? You can get an email, but you can also get a text message on your phone. It's called a smishing, which will indicate that, you know, someone tried to log into to your bank account and you need to restore access. And so you need to go to the link that is provided on the smishing text. So the content does matter. We know that. People are more aware nowadays for the Nigerian prince and the lottery scams, emails that you're getting. So people tend to ignore those. But we know that the fraudsters are constantly working on, you know, new content and new ways to lure you to get the information they need in order to victimize you. And they're doing a very good job, I have to tell you. I mean, one of the interesting projects, which, you know, we haven't really discussed, and maybe I should just mention here, one of the things we've done in the past with one of the companies we worked with was in the context of business email compromise. We were able to work with this company who essentially hacked the fraudsters. So, you know, the fraudster sent an email, right? And it was a business email compromise, right? Pretending to be the CEO of a company. And, you know, we worked with this company, which was essentially a spam filter. And what they did was they allow us to say, okay, let's play with the guy, right, on the other end. And so we did. And we say, okay, we're going to send you the money. But what you need to do is you need to click on this Ayola in order for you to get the sum that you want us to send to you. Most of the hackers did do that because they didn't really read the Ayola, which essentially suggested that they allowed the company to take over their email address. Once the company took over the email address, we were able to see what these guys are working on and the type of frauds that these guys are working on a monthly basis. The company back then took over 77 inboxes, and you can imagine what we were able to find there. I mean, thousands of emails that the bad guys were sending and were communicating with victims. We've seen a lot of money being sent to these criminals, and we saw them working and thinking about different types of frauds that folks are not even talking about. So, you know, there's a fraud to, there's a different type of fraud for different types of audiences. I have to say that, right? We're not going to talk about, you know, all of them. But in the context of the lottery scams, we know that folks are no longer working on that. I mean, rental scams are very high. Bank scams are high. But, you know, the lottery scams, no longer.
So I guess that gets us to talking about different ways of researching around crime. And in a previous episode, we were talking about the development of methods for cybercrime, that they're really moving to a point of being a lot more specific instruments and being able to discern weights of things rather than just the existence of things now. So I was just wondering your thoughts about matching particular types of research method or making use of the technologies that are available to us through the internet, such as that mechanism of providing a link with terms and conditions. How can we better make use of what the internet provides us in terms of methods to sort of advance a more granular understanding of cybercrime?
It's a great question. I think this is one of the things that we are trying to understand as well. I believe, and this is the approach that I'm sort of advocating in the context of my research, in the context of my classes, I believe that the technology we have nowadays allows us to get as close as possible to humans' decision-making process. In this sense, we can think about tools which will allow us to get as close as we can to the offender decision-making process, to the enabler decision-making process, the individuals who essentially support the offender's operation, the target's decision-making process, as well as the guardian's decision-making process. All we need to do is just explore and find those tools. because those tools are available. Your computer collects a lot of information about you. It collects a lot of information about decision you make in the event logs. And there are many other tools, right? Like honeypots, like IDSs, like IPSs, like, you know, a lot of really cool tools that the computer scientists, the cybersecurity experts use, which in my opinion, we can use as well in order to really understand decision-making processes and human behavior in cyberspace in a more direct way than simply ask someone to hypothesize what they would have done in this scenario or that scenario. The advantage of working with the internet and studying crime on the internet is that everything is there. All you have to do is just find a tool to collect it. It's just a matter of us scientists finding those tools to simply explore the world. This is not different than what, you know, other scientists have done before us. That's our duty as scientists. We can't be, in my opinion, fixated with one way of doing things. It simply doesn't work, right? In the context of pushing the envelope, in my opinion. Maybe other people will think differently, and that's fine. But I'm really curious about ways to understand behavior in cyberspace using technical tools, which in my opinion can really get us there.
There are interesting news stories about some people who'd ripped off Bitcoin. And the act they did was a number of years ago. It wasn't something that they did recently. But because of the nature of blockchain, every transaction that they undertook, and by all accounts, the efforts that they went to mask their laundering of illegal proceeds were quite extensive, but they were all meticulously recorded through the blockchain and through other mechanisms. So law enforcement was, many years later, able to just sort of slowly make their way through and trace these things and then eventually arrest the people. That sort of lends to what you're saying, that there are other opportunities that are potentially available to us through technology.
Look, if you want to understand the world, you should develop tools that will allow you to understand the world. And think about the telescope or the microscope, right? I mean, these are two different tools that at the end of the day change the way we think about the universe and us as humans. Those two tools that folks essentially developed allow us to explore the world in a more efficient, more precise way. Yeah, I mean, you can look at the sky and observe the stars, right, and come up with some interesting observations and conclusions. But when you have the telescope, your measurement is more precise. You can come up with more intelligent conclusions about the world. And I think that is what we need to do in the context of cyberspace as well. We have tools, you know, and if we don't have the tools, we need to continue working on developing those tools. But some of those tools are still available. We should at least explore working with them in order to really try and push the envelope.
To divert into a metaphor for a second, if, say, older methods that come from a traditional space that we're comfortable with are, say, perhaps like the imperial system of measurement, because you're in the United States and you're stuck with inches and feet, which is comfortable, but not necessarily precise. And we could move to something like a metric system that everybody uses and is quite accurate and is able to easily communicate very precise findings. Ergo, the United States should switch to metric.
I mean, I have no say in this in this argument, right? I'm not, and you know, NIST here is the institute to essentially, you know, decide what we use, right? National Institute of Science and Technology. I happen to be Israeli in my origin, right? So, you know, I'm more familiar and, to be frank, more comfortable with the metric system. So, you know, that's, I guess, my way to sort of, you know, dodge this question.
I guess the underlying point there is that it's not that one way is better than the other. It's just perhaps more suited to specific uses. And if you're comfortable with feet and inches, then maybe that's a way of getting to where you're going. But if you want to advance, then you're going to have to go to micrometers or picometers or something like that.
Well, it really depends on what you're trying to do, right? I mean, it really depends on your goal. And if your goal is to get to the moon, right? So it doesn't really matter if you work with the metric system or, you know, the US system, right? It doesn't matter, right? Because at the end of the day, the US were able to get to the moon, you know, before anyone else. What really matters is what you're trying to do. That will essentially will determine the approach you will take and the tools you will need to use in order to accomplish these goals.
So what are you trying to do now? What's your current research and what have we got to look forward to from the center in the near future?
We do a lot. I mean, we have several students working on different types of projects. We have one of our students working on online grooming, which is really interesting. Again, going back to the previous point you had about the research around a specific topic, most of the research we are familiar with, and we actually, the student actually ran a review, a scoping review of the literature. Most of the research around cyber grooming is driven by surveys. And so the research that my student is engaged in involved the use of honeypots. So what she does is essentially she developed this chatbot. And so she sits on those chats where we know the groomer sits and talk to the children. And the bot communicate with these groomers. I mean, we run experiments with them. And one of the experiments is a really cool experiment where we're trying to figure out what will happen once the child, our honeypot, tells the groomer that the parent is around, sort of speaking. It's a really interesting experiment. I'm not going to, you know, disclose the finding, right? Because, you know, I want the student to sort of talk about that, right? Really interesting and important findings, right? But again, the innovation there is by the fact that, again, we're working with real criminals and their decision-making process during the progression of a criminal event. So this is one of the projects that we're working on. We developed a relationship with several companies. We were trying to determine the actionability of different items that we send their way in the context of them being able to prevent and mitigate different types of crime that they experience on their turfs. Really, a lot's going on, right? You know, online romance fraud. I mean, we have students working on that and we collaborate with people from UTEP. On that, Timothy Dickinson is one of our collaborators, and of course Jordan Howell, right? So we all work on this project. Identity theft is huge right now, and we find that not too many people, not too many groups, not too many universities are talking about this. But the issue of synthetic identity is definitely an issue that, at least here in the United States, and I think in Canada as well, folks are already aware of, struggling with, and trying to find solution to. And we have already started doing that in the context of our group. Because a lot of what we find on those platforms are identity. Some of them are compromised. Many of them are synthetic. And I don't know if you know what you can do with a synthetic identity, but if you don't, you can do pretty much everything you can do with a compromised identity. And the cool thing about synthetic identity is that you take someone's name, someone else's social security numbers, bring in your address, and then you start stealing money. And unfortunately, the bureaus are having a very hard time figuring out the identity is synthetic. I'm not going to tell you why. I mean, you can figure it out yourself, right? But you know, that is one of the issues that we're spending a lot of time working on right now. So really a lot going on. I look forward to continue publishing with this really cool group of interdisciplinary scholars that I work with.
Oh, that's awesome. I look forward to it. Well, thanks for your time, and I look forward to what you've got coming up.
Thanks, man.
If you're involved in cyber, you're often expected to answer questions on everything from how Ultra could be more than Max, or whether it's better to buy NFTs with Dogecoin or Ethereum. Best way to get ahead of those wild questions is to ask an expert. We happen to have cornered one on digital forensics. Dr. Joshua James is a trainer, lecturer, and consultant for digital investigations. And somehow, while training police officers and consulting for the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, he's also managed to maintain a great blog and a YouTube channel, both called DFIR.science. Dr. James also tolerates my asinine questions. So let's take advantage of that and ask him this. In the news, law enforcement has talked about going dark as a problem, meaning they don't have access to information. The opposite end of that is that they have all of the information, and people have more and more data, digital information associated with their person and their life, their cell phone, cloud accounts, PC, tablet, Fitbit, etc., 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 etc. Shouldn't that make investigations really, really easy?
Well, the major presumption there is that law enforcement can actually get access to the data, right? So from your your mobile device or your Fitbit or whatever it is that you're dealing with, U.S. law enforcement might be able to get, can I say, relatively easy access to that kind of information, but the U.S. isn't the only country in the world. And all of those law enforcement agencies around the world are also seeing exactly the same devices, but most of the companies that are really interesting are located in the US. Well, if they want access to that information, massive amounts of information that's being created, you're looking at mutual legal assistance and just the ability to have international cooperation between your country and the US, which isn't a given. So it really depends on the political situation, like all sorts of things that can be affecting your investigation. So the first major assumption is that you can get access to that data. I would say most countries in the world have an extremely difficult time getting access. Even in the US, it's kind of hard, I would say, to get access to most of that data. But if you're looking at, I did a study with the UN a couple years ago, and basically any South American countries, they were making mutual legal assistance requests all the time to US companies for data like this, and just constantly rejected. And there's lots of different reasons for that, but they did have mutual legal assistance treaties in place, and they just couldn't get access. They just weren't even really entertained. Extremely high rejection rates for any type of cooperation. So most countries just don't have access to the data. The data exists. Being able to get the data to law enforcement is a huge problem outside of the US or wherever the service provider is hosted. Second is, imagine that you got 10 years of location data for a single person. Now you have to have the expertise to actually comb through that in a way that makes sense for your investigation. And a lot of groups don't even have that expertise, right? The data that you would receive from a service provider probably isn't standardized in any way. So you just have to get it and then process it yourself, which means that you have to have somebody who knows development, for example. Most digital investigators or just police officers in general are not developers. So they would have to get the data and then find some sort of expertise or learn the expertise most of the time to process the data in a way that makes sense and then try to actually pull out the stuff that's interesting for your case specifically. So that's a whole process. I mean, imagine you're a new data scientist. You've never gotten a piece of data before, and all of a sudden you're dumped with, you know, some sort of just huge data set, and you have to solve this by tomorrow, otherwise somebody dies. That would be an extreme ask, I think, for most people. So more data doesn't necessarily help us unless you have the ideal conditions to be able to actually get the data quickly, you know, on time, so you can actually do the investigation, and then the skills and the expertise to be able to process that data in a way that makes sense quickly. Yeah, there's commercial tools out there, but a lot of people can't afford those either. So there's a lot of barriers to that, I would say. Now, in terms of like a digital investigator dealing with suspect devices where they can actually seize the devices directly, you might have, you know, 3 or 4 laptops in a house and then 10 phones and maybe a couple hard drives, things like that. You would think that there would be just massive amounts of information on there that's useful for your investigation. Well, maybe only one of those laptops has any interesting evidence. But all of those devices are going to take 24 hours to process and a week to analyze. So you have all of these devices completely unrelated. You don't know which one is unrelated. Hopefully, we talked about triage before. Hopefully, triage can kind of help that situation a little bit, but you can't completely remove them because you might miss something. Yeah, so more data in those cases, and that's a normal case, is to just get a bunch of systems, only one of them is related. More data in that case is a huge hindrance because it takes a person to actually analyze all that and go through it. So more data does not necessarily mean more evidence. It might mean evidence could be located in more places. So for example, if you have syncing turned on between your laptop and a cloud service, you might be syncing some potential evidence up to the cloud. So that could be useful. But in general, most of the devices that we see aren't related to the case at all. So then it's just a huge waste of time and you still have to analyze everything.
Thank you again to Dr. Maiman for the conversation. He's learned a lot from the discussion, and I'm sure we're all looking forward to the studies coming out from his group there. Unfortunately, that was our last episode with Dr. James. If you couldn't tell, I had a great time asking him questions about digital investigations and digital forensics. If you want to hear more of his answers, you can head on over to dfir.science. This has been Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. It's produced by me, but it's made possible by the kind guests sharing their time and their research. You can find out more about the show at cybercrimeology.com. You can talk to me directly at Cybercrimeology on Twitter.